This presentation is the role of molecular imaging in infection and inflammation, a new way to do business. By way of introduction, we would like to introduce some of the topics that will be discussed in this presentation, beginning with historical perspectives. We will then discuss new agents to detect infection and inflammation. Specific topics regarding the infectious process as well as inflammatory processes will be individually discussed, including fever of unknown origin, spinal osteomyelitis and discitis, endocarditis, pocket infections, and specific inflammatory conditions such as sarcoid and inflammatory bowel disease. And then finally, a brief discussion on the role of molecular imaging in ARDS and potential for this area of research. So we will start with some of the better known agents that have been used historically for imaging infection or inflammatory conditions. The first is the technetium 99 phosphates, such as MDP or HDP, which were introduced in 1971 specifically for bone imaging. A bone scan using these agents is very sensitive to osteoblastic activity, which can occur in the setting of infection. However, these are not specific, and uptake may occur in other conditions such as cancer, arthritis, and trauma. When used as a three-phase technique, that is using flow, blood pool, and delayed imaging, you can increase specificity to some degree. Blood pool and blood flow imaging may be limited when evaluating spinal infection due to overlying blood pool activity, which is present in the cardiac blood pool and vascular structures of the thorax. The utility for localizing or identifying infection is largely limited to the bony structures only. This is an example of a three-phase bone scan. The upper panel shows rapid blood flow imaging over the feet, with the lower left-hand panel showing blood pool imaging, and the delayed imaging is seen in the lower right-hand panel. As we can see, the left foot, which shows progressive increased accumulation on blood pool imaging in the region of the forefoot and the toes, subsequently becomes more intense on blood pool imaging, and then later more focally localizes to bony structures of the foot on delayed imaging in the region of the third toe and possibly the third metacarpal or metatarsal. This is a positive three-phase bone scan, and this may be seen in the setting of osteomyelitis, but again, this is not entirely specific and may occur in other conditions such as acute gouty arthritis. Another agent which has been used historically is gallium-67 and has been available for several decades. It was the first agent used largely for localization of infection. This agent works in two specific ways. It binds to transferrin in the bloodstream as well as lactoferrin that is present at sites of infection, and then it also binds to siderophores in some bacteria. There may also be some nonspecific binding to leukocytes, which may aggregate at the site of an infection. Until recently, this has been the preferred method for evaluating spinal osteomyelitis and discitis. There are limitations in the spine, as gallium-67 is a weak bone agent in and of itself. Gallium-67 became very highly used during the early days of the HIV and AIDS epidemic, particularly back in the late 80s and early 90s. It was found to be very useful in confirming the presence of pneumocystis pneumonia. It has also been used historically for diagnosing and monitoring the treatment of sarcoidosis. It is no longer used for staging of lymphoma, nor its diagnosis and treatment monitoring, which has moved to FDG PET imaging in most instances. This is an example from the literature of a whole body gallium scan. On the left-hand side, the two images are frontal views of the whole body, and on the right, the two images are posterior views of the whole body. It is noted on the posterior views that there is an aggregation of activity in the lower thoracic spine area, and this corresponds to ongoing active osteomyelitis of the spine. There is also an accumulation in this patient's bilateral iliac artery stents. It is uncertain whether the stents were seeded from the spinal process or vice versa, but both areas show ongoing infection. Another example from the literature is of pneumocystis pneumonia in an HIV-positive patient. We can see intense activity throughout both lungs to the point that the position of the heart appears absent or photopenic. This indicates very high levels of lung uptake, and when compared to liver uptake, as you can see in the right upper quadrant, the uptake is quite intense. Another agent which most are familiar with is the use of indium-111 tagged white blood cells, and this was developed for infection in 1990. It is very useful for detecting occult abscesses and has been excellent for the detection of osteomyelitis in the extremities when paired with MDP or HDP bone scan. It is also useful for evaluating prosthetic joint replacements and may be supplemented with bone agents as well, or also the use of sulfur colloid. This study can be limited in the setting of patients with low white blood cell counts of less than 2,000. Complex preparation is a drawback to this procedure, as it requires separation of the white blood cells for labeling. These white blood cells are then re-injected into the patient and may have to be scanned up to 72 hours later. This is limited in the evaluation of spinal osteomyelitis and discitis due to its normal biodistribution and uptake in normal bony structures. It is limited in chronic infection, where there may be a predominantly lymphocytic infiltration. There is also a technetium-labeled HMPAO white blood cell product, which can be used as well, but can be limited due to its shorter half-life. This is anterior and posterior images of a whole-body indium-111 white blood cell scan. We see normal uptake throughout much of the skeleton, which verifies how this can be limited in the setting of spinal osteomyelitis. We see normal uptake in liver as well as in spleen on the posterior image. On the anterior image, we see an abnormal accumulation within the abdomen as indicated by the arrow, and this corresponded to an abscess. Another example from the literature showing a combination exam using tagged white blood cell scans with technetium-99M sulfur colloid. When we refer to the far right image on the upper row, we see uptake in the distal tibia as well as uptake of white blood cells in what may be the talus or portions of the midfoot. When we compare it to technetium sulfur colloid, we see uptake only in the distal tibia but not in the hindfoot. The uptake in the distal tibia is therefore related to marrow activation rather than infection, while the uptake in the hindfoot showing absence of colloid but high white blood cell accumulation corresponds to osteomyelitis. Moving on to some of the newer agents now available, we will predominantly be discussing FDG and its uses in various disease entities and infections. Other agents besides FDG include indium-111 biotin. They're already labeled antibiotics and antimicrobial peptides. Gallium-68 PET is available, in contradistinction to gallium-67, which is used in nuclear imaging. And there are also F18 labeled white blood cell scans. As noted, we will be discussing FDG for the most part, but it is noteworthy that gallium-68 is on this list, as it is becoming a new player in oncologic imaging with the arrival of gallium-68 dotatate, and these generators may become more available in the future to be used for infection imaging. F18-FDG is a radiotracer most practitioners are familiar with in the realm of oncology. When performed with hybrid PET-CT imaging, FDG is very sensitive for the detection of infection and inflammation. CT scan helps increase the specificity of the exam. FDG is nonspecific and may accumulate in various conditions such as neoplasm, infection, and inflammation. This is a picture of the molecular structure of FDG. It is simply a glucose molecule in all senses except for the replacement of a hydroxyl group at this location with an F18 atom. So we will move on to fever of unknown origin. This is defined as temperature of greater than 100.9 degrees Fahrenheit, lasting more than 3 weeks, with no source of fever identified. There have been over 200 causes for fever of unknown origin described. Historically, these numerous etiologies have been grouped into four categories, with obviously the most common category pertaining to infectious etiologies. The other categories include malignancy as a cause of fever of unknown origin, autoimmune or inflammatory states, and then miscellaneous conditions including things like drug fever, thyroiditis, and DVT or septic thrombophlebitis. FDG PET-CT can detect the vast majority of these conditions in the first three groups mentioned above. Advantages of FDG PET-CT over other imaging procedures include lower cost in many situations, quicker results, and better image quality. There have only been a handful of prospective studies comparing FDG PET-CT to other imaging techniques. Most studies do show that PET can identify foci of occult abscess, TB, vasculitis, and other etiologies with sensitivities of up to 90%. FDG PET has also been shown to have a sensitivity and specificity of 100% and 92% respectively in the setting of chronic osteomyelitis. A prospective study presented in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine in 2008 reviewed 48 patients with fever of unknown origin who underwent FDG PET-CT evaluation. This study showed a specificity of 90% for excluding a focal infectious or inflammatory process, and the overall sensitivity for this entire patient population was 46%. However, when the cause of the FUO was determined to be a focal process, the sensitivity of this technique increased to 100% with a specificity of 81%. The positive predictive value was also 81% with a negative predictive value of 100% and an accuracy of 90%. Several causes were determined for the negative studies, and they were almost exclusively due to systemic or iatrogenic causes. These included typhoid, Q fever, CMV, and drug fever. In others with no cause identified and a negative PET, This study revealed that the FUO resolved spontaneously with no inflammatory, infectious, or malignant cause for the fever and follow-up examination up to 36 months. This is an excerpt from the Anthem guidelines regarding osteomyelitis, Anthem being one of the largest insurance providers in this country. And it states that the pooled sensitivity demonstrated that PET was the most sensitive technique with a sensitivity of 96%. And they compared this to bone scintigraphy, white blood cell scintigraphy, and combined bone and leukocyte scintigraphy. So it is clearly evident that FDG, when put in this context from the perspective of an insurance provider, is very highly effective. Some examples of fever of unknown origin. This is a female patient who had unexplained fever, and we have images from left to right, axial PET, axial fused PET CT, and then axial CT. On the far right image, the arrow and the arrowhead are pointing to adnexal cysts. On the PET imaging, however, only the process in the right adnexa shows uptake, and this is shown on the fused images in the middle. The cyst on the left does not show uptake, and on the subsequent follow-up, it was determined that the process in the right adnexa was indeed an ovarian abscess. This is an example from our practice that we see very commonly when performing PET CT. We have axial PET, axial CT, and axial fused images from left to right. We see intense accumulation in both lobes of the thyroid on the PET image, and this is confirmed and localized on the fused image. This is very nonspecific, but is generally not indicative of cancer, but may represent thyroiditis of unknown etiology. Frequently, this represents chronic Hashimoto's thyroiditis. In contrast, axial CT, axial PET, and axial fused images show an intense accumulation localizing to the left lobe of the thyroid. When this occurs, this must be assumed to be cancer until proven otherwise, although it may simply represent a hyperfunctioning nodule. In this setting, biopsy is typically recommended. And another example from our practice of a patient being evaluated and staged for lung cancer shows axial PET, axial lung window CT, and axial fused images. On the axial PET imaging, we see an intense accumulation corresponding to the patient's known lung cancer, which corresponds to this area on the fused imaging on the far right image. But we also see low-level patchy uptake throughout both lungs, and when we review the CT of the lungs at lung window setting, we see diffuse pulmonary fibrosis. This is an example of inflammatory uptake in the lungs related to ongoing fibrosis with focal accumulation in a patient with known lung cancer. We will move on to spondylodiscitis. This is defined as infection involving the disc space and adjacent vertebrae. This usually spreads hematogenously, but may also result from direct inoculation or iatrogenic causes, or possibly spread from neighboring soft tissue infection. There is typically a bimodal age distribution comprised of a pediatric population and then adults, usually over the age of 50. Various risk factors have been ascribed to this process and include ongoing infection elsewhere, particularly endocarditis, prior spinal surgery, IV drug abuse, diabetes, and forms of chronic immunosuppression, including steroid use. The most common bacterial etiology is Staph aureus, which accounts for 55 to 65%. Other infectious agents include strep viridans, gram-negative bacteria, and tuberculosis. When evaluating spondylodiscitis, MRI is recommended as the modality of choice for initial evaluation. Its sensitivity is 96% with specificity of 93% and an accuracy of 94%. When adding gadolinium as a contrast agent, the sensitivity increases for detection of early or subtle changes of spondylodiscitis. As a supplement, molecular imaging can be used as a tool for indeterminate or negative cases, or when there is still strong suspicion of discitis. MDP bone scan will not show adjacent soft tissue infection, and paraspinous soft tissue evaluation is very limited on three-phase bone scans in the thoracic spine due to blood pool activity, as we have discussed previously. Gallium-67 is useful, but may be limited also as it is considered a weak bone agent, and this may show increased uptake at the site of infection due to normal biodistribution in skeletal structures. Indium-111 white blood cells may also be limited due to normal biodistribution in bone, with up to 50% of cases showing decreased or absent uptake compared to adjacent normal structures. There have been several studies that have consistently shown that FDG PET is better than MDP, gallium-67, and tagged white blood cells. FDG has been shown to be at least as good as MRI, and FDG PET is better than MRI in early or low-grade spinal infections with both sensitivity and specificity of 100% compared to 50% and 96% for MRI. A study in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine showed in 70 patients with suspected spondylodiscitis who were evaluated with MRI versus PET that the diagnostic accuracy of MRI within 2 weeks of onset of symptoms was only 56%, but this later improved to 80% when symptoms have been present for over 2 weeks. On the other hand, FDG PET showed sensitivity and specificity of 98% and 95% with an accuracy of 97%, with no difference if whether the scan was performed before or after two weeks of onset of symptoms. FDG PET is also useful for evaluating spinal hardware infection. This may be problematic with MRI due to susceptibility artifacts, which can be caused by the metallic components of the hardware. It may also be used to monitor the treatment of spondylodiscitis, that is, if a baseline study is performed and then treatment is instituted, follow-up scans when there has been resolution of the infection may show absence of FDG abnormality. There are limitations with FDG PET, which may occur in the presence of metastatic malignancy or other superimposed inflammatory processes, such as from degenerative disc disease. This is an example from the literature showing two fused images from left to right and an MRI image on the far right. On the MRI image, this sagittal T2 weighted study shows uptake in L5, L4, and L5 with some uptake in the disk space as well, or rather increased signal in the disk space. When we look at the fused images at the same level from the PET CT, on the left we see increased activity along the end plates of the L4 and L5 vertebral bodies, and on the central image there is apparent activity within the disk space. And this was shown to be discitis with osteomyelitis of the L4 and L5 vertebral bodies. This is an example from our practice in a patient who presented with back pain. This image shows sagittal T2 and STIR imaging, and there is intense uptake or intense increased signal at the level of involvement in adjacent vertebral bodies, as well as increased signal in the disc space. For further evaluation, the patient underwent a three-phase bone scan paired with an indium-111 tagged white blood cell scan. These are images from the SPECT CT of the bone scan portion of the examination. We have sagittal CT, sagittal SPECT, and sagittal fused images. And this reveals uptake corresponding to the same level of abnormalities noted on the previous MRI at T9 and T10. But this is non-specific, not necessarily indicating the presence of acute infection, but this could actually represent ongoing healing from a prior infection. The white blood cell study, on the other hand, showed no uptake at this level. This is sagittal CT, sagittal SPECT, and sagittal fused imaging as we go from left to right. And we see that there is no white cell aggregation at the level of involvement. We can see the level of involvement on the CT, but no abnormal accumulation of white cells on the SPECT imaging. At this point, this was considered indeterminate for infection, and it was even questioned whether there could be an ongoing malignant process present based on the absence of white blood cells. The patient subsequently underwent an FDG scan with PET CT, and we see sagittal CT, sagittal PET, and sagittal fused images. There is increased activity at the T9-10 level, both within the disk space and within the adjacent end plates of T9 and T10. At this point, it was determined that this was more in keeping with infection and that this represented discitis with ongoing adjacent osteomyelitis of the adjacent vertebrae. Of note, this patient did have a standard PET CT from the skull base through the thighs, and there was no other evidence of any potential malignancy. As confirmatory evidence, this patient ultimately underwent a CT-guided aspiration at the T9-10 level, and this aspirate proved that there was osteomyelitis present. The next special topic is endocarditis. This is considered infection of the endocardium. It typically involves the cardiac valves, which occurs due to their absence of a direct blood supply. About 80% of the infections will involve the mitral or aortic valves, with about 20% involving the right side cardiac valves. The most common cause of valvular endocarditis is usually the result of a structural or functional abnormality of the valve itself, including conditions such as mitral valve prolapse, bicuspid valve, or damage as a result of previous rheumatic disease. The origin of the infection can be extensive, including dental disease or dental manipulation, and this is why many patients have to have prophylaxis prior to any dental procedure, particularly those with mitral valve prolapse. Indwelling or implantable devices may also be a cause of infection, as can any other host source of infection. Many right-side cardiac valvular infections are the result of intravenous drug abuse. The most common causative agent similar to spinal infection is Staph aureus, but also with streptococci species. 10 to 20% may be caused by fastidious organisms, part of the HACCP grouping, which include bacterial etiologies such as Haemophilus and Cardiobacterium. The diagnosis of endocarditis is usually made in the setting of clinical suspicion, with positive blood cultures revealing bacteria, as well as the use of echocardiography, particularly transesophageal echocardiography. MRI has been shown to detect valvular vegetations, and this can be augmented with contrast-enhanced sequences. The diagnosis of endocarditis is usually performed with the Duke criteria or modified Duke criteria. The modified Duke criteria are composed of two major criteria, or two separate criteria, major and minor criteria. The major criteria include two separate positive blood cultures revealing microorganism growth that are typical for endocarditis with the agents we've already discussed most commonly seen. Another major criteria is echocardiographic evidence of endocardial involvement, typically with valvular lesions, including vegetation, abscess, or new partial dehiscence of a prosthetic valve, and also development of new valvular regurgitation in an otherwise healthy valve prior to onset of symptoms. There are several minor criteria, including predisposing conditions, a temperature of greater than 38 degrees Celsius, the onset of various vascular phenomenon may also be minor criteria, and these include arterial emboli, septic pulmonary infarcts, mycotic aneurysm, and others. There are immunological phenomena which may predispose to endocarditis, including glomerulonephritis. Other things that may be seen clinically are ocellar nodes, Roth spots, and positive rheumatoid factor. Studies have shown that in the setting of prosthetic valves and implantable cardiac devices, FDG PET-CT provides additional value beyond the Duke criteria. When PET is combined with CTA or CT angiography when using the Duke criteria, the diagnostic capability was improved over PET-CT without the use of angiography. There was a cross-sectional study in 2016 presented in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine, which reviewed the utility of FDG PET-CT in the setting of prosthetic valves and implantable cardiac devices. The study concluded that PET-CT should be considered early in the evaluation of suspected endocarditis when prosthetic valves or devices are present. This study further stated that FDG PET-CT is not as useful in the setting of native valves, but might be considered in the initial assessment of fever of unknown origin or with positive blood cultures to look for non-cardiac causes. This is an example from the literature of an infected prosthetic aortic valve. The top row shows axial and coronal CT images. The middle row shows axial and coronal fused images. And then the bottom row shows axial and coronal PET images. On the CT images, we can see the metallic ring indicating the location of the aortic valve prosthesis. On fused and on PET images, we see intense accumulation around the valve structure, indicating that there is ongoing infection present, and this confirmed the presence of endocarditis. This is another example from the literature showing axial CT, axial PET, and axial fused images. On the axial CT, we see the metallic mitral valve prosthesis, and on the PET and fused images, we see uptake in the region of the mitral valve prosthesis, which again confirms the presence of infection. This is a case that actually occurred at our hospital, and this patient had positive blood cultures but with a negative initial transesophageal echo. The patient had a fever of unknown origin, but there was still suspicion of endocarditis based on other clinical parameters. We see axial fused images, axial CT, and axial PET images. The arrow is pointing to an accumulation in the region of the aortic valve. We know our position based on the CT, as we see the base of the aorta in the slice. And there is uptake on the PET image at the estimated position of the aortic valve. This patient had had a prior CT angio for other reasons prior to the study. This was correlated with the subsequent PET CT just demonstrated on the previous slide. Upon review, it was noticed that there was actually an outpouching in the region of the sinus of Valsalva, which subsequently was confirmed as a small aneurysm of the sinus of Valsalva. Within this area, there is a small filling defect, which was retrospectively considered to represent a vagitation in the region of this sinus of Valsalva aneurysm. In the same vein as endocarditis, pocket infection is considered. This is an infection that may occur within or around implantable cardiac devices such as pacemakers or AICDs. MRI and CT may be severely limited for evaluating infections related to these devices, largely as a result of metallic artifacts, which may be demonstrated as susceptibility on MRI or streak artifact on CT. In addition, because of these devices, MRI may be an absolute contraindication due to problems with the device or malfunction. When evaluating a device where there is a pocket in place, there are three areas that must be assessed: the superficial or surrounding soft tissue around the pocket should be evaluated, the pocket itself, that is the space where the electronic device resides, should be evaluated, and the leads that emanate from the generator device must also be scrutinized. Echocardiography may be used to evaluate the intracardiac lead where an abnormality or vegetation may be observed, but this does not determine if an acute infection is present. A vegetation could simply represent a bland vegetation or thrombus or fibrin deposit. There was an investigation that looked at the early diagnosis of pocket infections in implantable cardiac devices. 46 of 80 patients in this series had suspected pocket infections. Patients who required extraction of the device, who were evaluated with PET CT, had significantly higher FDG uptake around the device than the control patients. These are two examples from the literature. The one on the left shows axial CT, axial PET, and axial fused images with a 3D MIP image in the bottom right-hand corner. We can see the streak artifact representing the location of the device in the right chest wall on the CT image in the upper left-hand corner. When we refer to the fused and PET images, there is no evidence of abnormal accumulation in the region of the device, specifically in the device pocket. On the other hand, the example on the right side of the screen shows axial CT, axial PET, and axial fused images with 3D MIP image in the lower right-hand corner. In this example, where the device is in the left chest wall, we do see some abnormal accumulation on the PET imaging, on both the PET and the fused imaging. When we look at the 3D image, there's clearly an accumulation around the device itself, localizing to the region of the pocket, but there is also activity extending from the region of the pocket along the lead, and this would suggest that there is infection of not only the pocket, but also propagation of the infection along the proximal aspect of the lead as it traverses towards the heart. Moving on to various inflammatory conditions, there's extensive studied as well as anecdotal evidence that FDG PET can be used to detect inflammatory conditions. These conditions may be associated with fever or other clinical findings that may suggest an infection or inflammatory process is present. Examples of such conditions include Crohn's disease, sarcoidosis, vasculitis, rheumatologic disease, and many others that may show uptake on FDG PET imaging. Sarcoidosis is quite common in clinical practice. It is one of the proverbial enemies of oncologic PET. Anybody who has done PET CT for staging or treatment monitoring or other reasons for evaluating a patient with cancer has probably encountered uptake in the mediastinum and the hilar lymph nodes. Many patients may have mediastinal and hilar uptake, suggesting malignant disease when performing staging for a known malignancy. Besides sarcoid, nonspecific pulmonary inflammation may cause reactive lymph node uptake in the hilar. This is often seen in patients who are being evaluated for lung cancer, but who also may have COPD or chronic bronchitis, where there is an underlying low-grade inflammatory process in the lungs or the bronchi with subsequent uptake in hilar or mediastinal lymph nodes, period. This can confound the evaluation for determining whether the uptake is related to cancer or an inflammatory condition. When performing PET for malignancy, it is important to consider the typical spread pattern of the malignancy in question. That is, does the uptake in the hilum or the mediastinum make sense for the type of malignancy that is being evaluated, such as a colon cancer, which generally will spread through the mesenteric circulation and portal vein to the liver, but does not typically involve the hilar or mediastinal lymph nodes unless very advanced disease is present. This is an example of a patient with hilar adenopathy and FDG uptake who was being evaluated for cancer but also had a diagnosis of sarcoidosis. Crohn's disease shows a high sensitivity for detection with PET CT in active disease segments. A study in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine in 2007 showed a sensitivity for detecting these diseased segments by, as determined by endoscopy, of 73%. Sensitivity for detection of lesions with ulcerations or strictures, as determined by endoscopy, was 100%. PET can also detect small bowel lesions that may not be accessible to endoscopy. This is an example of a patient who underwent PET CT for other reasons and was found to have intense accumulation in the left colon. We see axial PET, axial CT, and axial fused images with segmental uptake in a portion of the left colon that was subsequently proven endoscopically to represent Crohn's disease. FDG PET may detect unsuspected vasculitis as a cause of fever or other symptoms. It may also be used to evaluate prosthetic graft infection. Studies have evaluated inflammation of unknown origin with FDG PET, where there was elevated SED rate and fever, and it was found that FDG contributed to the diagnosis and detection of the source of FUO in these patients. This is an example of a patient who has large vessel vasculitis. We see a MIP image on the left with coronal CT and coronal fused images on the right side of the screen. Most notably, on the fused images, we can see track-like accumulation in the ascending aorta where there was inflammatory change and vasculitis present. The arrows are pointing at some pericardial uptake, and it is uncertain if this relates to the vasculitic process. On the 3D MIP image, we see extensive uptake along the location of the aorta as it continues into the abdomen, as well as the subclavian and carotid vessels. One final consideration is that in patients who are acutely ill, there is a possible development or onset of ARDS or adult respiratory distress syndrome, which can contribute to significant morbidity and mortality. Sepsis is one of several conditions that may lead to ARDS, and this condition is felt to occur as a result of neutrophilic activation. With FDG PET, uptake may be seen in areas of pulmonary infection visible on CT or other imaging modality, but you may see FDG uptake in normal lung, which can predict subsequent involvement of ARDS in these areas, which would then be at risk for ventilator-related injury. There was a small series consisting of only about 5 patients that showed patients with elevated FDG uptake in a portion of the lung went on to develop ARDS, while those who did not have FDG uptake anywhere in the lung were weaned from the ventilator. These are images from that particular study. On the left, we have axial PET and axial CT with lung windows. There are regions of interest drawn around each of the two lungs on this example, and we see no evidence of FDG accumulation within either lung in the left-hand patient. This patient never progressed to ARDS and was successfully weaned from the ventilator. On the right-hand side, we also see axial PET and axial CT images with regions of interest around the lungs. There is intense FDG uptake within the posterior lungs bilaterally, and this coincides with areas of consolidation on the CT scan, this patient ultimately progressed to ARDS. This information is very preliminary, and much more research needs to be done in this regard as to the advantages and utility of PET or other molecular imaging and evaluating for possible development of ARDS. This concludes our presentation of molecular imaging in infection and inflammation. If there are any questions with regard to this presentation, feel free to contact customer support.
All right, Jackson, that looked good.
All right, man.
That was awesome. And cool. I learned something too.